The following is a presentation of ARSC, the Association for Recorded Sound Collections.
First of all, a quick show of hands. How many of you have read the journal article on the Mapleson cylinders? Ask you know who. Ask the chairman of our class. Ask Mike Gray. He'll tell you. This is simply because I don't want to go over the same ground, except, as they say, to bring in a few things. In particular, one piece of ground I will retrace right now, and that is to say that our work would not have been possible without the enterprise of Philip L. Miller, who at the time the cylinders were first acquired by the library, the first batch, was working as assistant chief of the music division under Carlton Sprague Smith, and then of course our major benefactor in that and many other ways in terms of building up the vocal side of the collection, the late G. Lauder Greenway, God rest his soul. By the most ironic coincidence, the very day that we finished taping the last Mapleson cylinder, I had planned to call him the very next morning to say, "Lauder, we finally did it." And instead, I read the obituary pages of the New York Times. As they say, such are the small ironies of life and other things. But as they say, Phil and Lauder, between them, made the whole thing possible. I will also say that some of the development work was financed out of special funds that were set up for, as they say, the acquisition of materials, and this is a form of acquisition. These funds were furnished by Francis Gillette through the Rhode Island Corporation Fund. And believe me, we are enormously grateful for the helping hands. We need all we can get. Those of you who have read the journal piece may remember that the last line was, "Stay tuned for our next thrilling installment." Because as soon as we got through the actual taping of the cylinders from the boxes, we had a long pull ahead of us because we just taped these things just as they came from the box to minimize the amount of handling. And then, of course, there had to be a lot of... Tom made cassettes for me, as they say, just again as we taped them. There was a long period of study to work out the pitching, to determine precisely what was being sung. And we discovered a few things that nobody else knew about. As you probably noted in the journal article, we discovered that there had been a piece of Paderewski's opera Man Ru, which had its American premiere in 1902. Nobody ever discovered this thing. It had been on these cylinders all the time. In fact, I was about to dismiss the thing as useless because it had a lot of other stuff on it. But of course, Tom put everything, absolutely everything, on the tape, and I had this stuff at home with my earphones clamped over my noggin. And I began to listen, you know, carefully. Because this was stuff, you know, you heard the Met chorus, and then you heard some soloists. The music was definitely unfamiliar, and then the Mapleson children came in. And, you know, you just, well, what the devil is all this nonsense? But then, you know, I listened again. I said, this is no nonsense. This is something, you know, this is not familiar repertory. So then I began to go through all of the unusual repertory that had been done at the Met between 1900 and 03, and I finally narrowed it down. I said, it's probably, I looked at all these various scores of O Salambo and a couple of other things, and didn't see anything that looked like what I was listening to. The thing that looked nearest was a score in the music division stacks that once belonged to Madame Alda, of Monroe. And then I began to thumb through it. And then finally I had one of the guys in the music division play the intrepids for me. And the thing gradually began to come together. And then it turned out that Will Lerner at Music Masters had a tape of a Polish radio performance of the thing. Well, you know, there's no sense doing guesswork. If you're going to be sure, you'd better be real sure. Anyway, it turned out that this was a piece from Mac 3, Scene 2 of Monroe with Fritzy Scheff. Such are the funny things that you discover. But the great adventure for me of this whole operation, and the thing that set us off on it, was again the incident that I mentioned in the earlier journal article, where Tom and I, you know, were going along with Melva singing the Jewel song from Faust in 1901, and there's a locked groove, and suddenly, bingo, hello, we're in the Metropolitan Opera Library. This is on a 19-1 cylinder. It's April 5th, 1909, and we've just come home from a windy walk on Brooklyn Bridge. Well, what the deuce have we got here? As they say, the first few times we heard some of these things, first of all, the words were very hard to distinguish. But it took a little while for the import of this thing to dawn on me, but the first thing that struck me was, why in the devil would a fellow of Mapleson's discernment, taste, with all his, not only his own experience, but his family's experience. His uncle was the famous impresario, Colonel Mapleson. The line of the Mapleson family as music librarians traces back to England all the way to 1711. They were involved in the production of Handel's Rinaldo. And old man Lionel collected all the family goodies and kept them in his library rooms at the Metropolitan Opera. And when Lionel's son, Alfred, succeeded to the position after Lionel's death, he stayed there until 45. Then he decided to set up his own business down the street a piece as the Mapleson Music Library, at that time handling mostly performing parts and scores for opera. And when he went, he cleaned everything out. There is not one single scrap of Mapleson memorabilia to be found in the Metropolitan Opera archives. But at any rate, as I say, this business of the children set me off on a quest of documenting every single aspect of the provenance of these cylinders that I could possibly find. So much stuff, as again, going back to the other article, you know, has been written about Edison designed the horn for Mapleson. Mapleson had to stop recording at the end of the season of 1903 because Melba almost got beamed, first by a cylinder. The newer stories, I think Michael Scott in the Record of Singing says the whole machine came crashing down. As they say, how they love to embroider on these things. And my attitude toward the history of these things, just as Tom's attitude toward the sound, is that we were going to start this thing, in a sense, absolutely tabula rasa, and not take anything for granted, and don't say something is so unless, by golly, you can confirm it from a third party, source, corroborating source, unimpeachable. And if you got to speculate, say it's speculation, and say why you're speculating. A typical example is the business of the big horn. Maybe you can see this picture. We were supposed to have a set of slides, but as they say, they got lost in the wash somewhere. But you can see the big horn, I think, even at that distance. The horn is almost as big as Mapleson himself. And again, the legend goes that, that he had Edison design the horn for him. Well, let's, as they say, back up a little bit on this. So as I say, I consulted every possible source. I talked to the heirs of William Seltzum of the International Record Collectors Club, which was first responsible for issuing some of the cylinders for shall we say, subscription commercial distribution. As they say, I talked to everybody all up and down the pike that ever had anything to do with these things, that was still alive, of course. Finally, I had done, and then I, of course, wrote letters to Alfred Mapleson at his home in Nassau County. I didn't, and then I found that the Mapleson Music Library was still functioning and alive and well out in Lindenhurst. I had the very interesting experience that these people, I might write them letters, as they say, as long as your arm, but they would get back to me by phone. I talked with Alfred a few times, and it was pretty clear to me that in his earlier days, especially when these cylinders had first been noised about in the 30s and then again in the 50s, that probably the guy had been pestered to death by collectors wanting to get at more cylinders and this, that, and the other. And I had the feeling that he was, you know, kind of fed up with the whole thing and was perhaps putting me on a little bit. Anyway, he, you know, some of the observations he made were, you know, didn't quite make sense. Fortunately, his son, Peter, collaborates with him in the running of the music library out on Long Island, which now deals primarily in performing materials for ballet. And I discovered that basically it was easier to deal with Peter. It turns out that Alfred is a little deaf. He's 75 years old, and the memory is not quite what it was. A perfectly lovely man, I might add. Just a great human being. But I had a chance to talk with Peter, and Peter seemed to be more of a mind to understand what we were trying to do and to think a little bit about not only preserving the cylinders, but maybe one day even getting all of that Mapleson memorabilia from 1711 on. You wouldn't believe what there is in that house. That is sitting in a little old frame house on Long Island heated by a coal fire. Exactly. But it is a family property, and they have a very family attitude toward it, and you have to go slow. But at any rate, as they say, ittle by bittle, I finally got to the point where I had sufficient chutzpah to say, well, I had asked Peter, I said, are there diaries? He said, yeah. And finally I got the chutzpah. I said, can I come out there and look at the diaries and other things pertaining to the cylinders? And by the way, is the machine still in existence? And he allowed is that they had a machine. So out I come on December 15, which is the day before I reach survivor status. Age 65. It was raining cats and dogs, but I was very cordially received. They had everything out there, the family photograph album. The diaries were up there on the shelf year by year. He had kept these diaries, Lionel, since he was about 16 years old, year by year. There was an Edison machine on the table, but it was not the machine in the photographs. The machine in the photographs is an Edison home model suitcase type. This thing was a triumph. Suddenly certain other things began to come together after I had done a little further research after that visit. Well, I spent the whole day reading the diaries, of course working primarily from about 1900, intensively from 1900 through about 1912, and then spot checking mostly from around the time Lionel began training son Alfred into the business, which would have been in the early 20s, and then, of course, the last year, because I wanted to find out, well, what about the Geraldine Farrar introduction that got William Seltzum into Mapleson so that he got the loan of the cylinders, and all this stuff. Well, I found, as they say, more and less than I expected. The most wonderful thing I found were, of course, some diary entries. First of all, you find out how he got the machine. Mr. Edison didn't have a darn thing to do with it. Tuesday, March 20th, 1900. Today, my long-cherished desire is satisfied. I purchased an Edison home phonograph for $30. In the evening, I took it up Shea Helen, that's his wife. People there all spent a merry evening with the beautiful instrument. The very next day, Wednesday, March 21, dear old Leo Stern invited me to see his phonograph. His valse, sung by his wife, Miss Susan Adams, perfect. He very kindly presented me with the Bettini recorder and reproducer, delightful, valuable gift. Sound familiar? So what's new? Somebody gives you a top-of-the-line cartridge? A word about Leo Stern. Leo Stern may have been Susan Adams' husband, but he was a very fine cellist in his own right. He gave the world premiere of the Dvorak Cello Concerto under Dvorak in London. So, as they say, small potatoes this fellow wasn't. The next day, Thursday, March 22nd, for the present, I neither work properly, nor eat, nor sleep. I am a phonograph maniac. Always making or buying records. The Bettini apparatus is simply perfect. Then we come to the story that Alfred Mapleson tells, and that has been repeated elsewhere in the literature, but not verified. I doubt if it ever will be verified unequivocally, except through what Alfred had to say. I believe that John Stratton made reference to this either in his article in the Record Collector back in the 1960s, or he may have mentioned it in one of the articles that he did for Recorded Sound, the British Institute, in which it is said that hundreds and hundreds of cylinders, the best of them, perished in England from the climate. At this point, even without corroborating evidence, I am rather inclined to believe this story because of certain things that Alfred said. Alfred said that I remember as a child going up to the attic in the family home in Bartholomew Road, Highgate, and seeing boxes and boxes and boxes of cylinders. The fact of the matter is that Lionel maintained British citizenship until the very end of his life. He never spent a 4th of July in this country until the last day of his life. In the early days in the Metropolitan, he started at the Met, by the way, only 4 years or so after it opened. In the early days, I took a look at the Met paybooks, and they paid him in British pounds for many, many years, just as they paid many of their singers in their local currency. No, those paybooks were very interesting. That was the only thing I found out about Mapleson in the Met Archives. But then you see an entry for April 28. We're still in 1900. At this time, he was using the phonograph, just experimenting, playing around with it, using it the way we would use a cassette recorder. And also, of course, erasing the things, only shaving them instead. It's very interesting, as a matter of fact, when we go through these cylinders and record them, there are a couple of them, one from De Valterra that is shaven to a razor's edge. It's just as thin as can be. It was used and used and used, and sometimes he didn't shave them all the way, so you get some nice overdubbing. Quite fascinating. Anyway, April 28, sailed for Europe by SS Stottendam, Holland-America line. Managed to get the phonograph outfit and nearly 100 wax cylinders safely on board together with our numerous belongings. So that's, anyway, how he got the phonograph. What about the Edison legend? Again, you have to put it together from circumstantial evidence, but Edison did not start to get into grand opera in a serious way until roughly 1905-06. As was the custom in those days, and now, and certainly in the good old days of Paola, the Edison reps romanced everybody and his brother on the Met staff in order to get at the singers. So So, as they say, the house physician got a Triumph phonograph, and so did Mr. Mapleson. By that time, he had long since stopped recording on the stage. How did this horn get built? Why did he really stop recording? Let's pick up, why did he stop recording? All right, possibly things did begin to drop down on the very expensive talent 40 or 50 feet below. But there were a couple of other circumstances that nobody ever troubles to mention, which is to say that the Metropolitan Opera changed management beginning with the season of 1903-04. From the easygoing Maurice Grau, they got somebody that I gather was a kind of a tough-minded Prussian character by the name of Heinrich Conried. And so I suspect that Conried not only ran a tighter ship, but one of our younger staff members, who was a Wagnerian scholar, let drop to me one day as we were working away at the Maplesons in the sound studio, did you know that Conried had the whole backstage area of the Met rebuilt for the American premiere of Parsifal, which took place that year? And this probably included Mapleson's vantage point in the flies for recording. At any rate, given the dozen or so non-operatic cylinders that we have, we got four piano cylinders and maybe a dozen or so orchestra cylinders there, a study of the Metropolitan Opera programs of that period seems to indicate that Mapleson did a few desultory recordings from the Sunday evening concerts of the orchestra and then just lost interest. You then go further in the diaries. You see that he is building an a little miniature stage for his children, who are now, as they say, getting to be real lively little tads. In 1909, in March, you get an entry which says, "History repeats itself. We have got the phonograph working again." So it is quite clear that the reason you get Mapleson and his children, it turns out, between 1909 and 1912, is because he was using this as an entertainment vehicle for his kids, no more, no less. And since presumably all the best of the cylinders were in England, or as Alfred Mapleson said, what was left in America was the bottom of the barrel. That's exactly the phrase that that Alfred used in describing these. And so, you know, you have an end of a cylinder here like you have an end of a piece of a cassette or whatever. So why not turn it over to the kiddies? And that seems to be the answer to the children. Now, getting back to a few more details, again from the diaries, or shall we say related to the diaries. So he had his home phonograph. So he started experimenting around. Now, what is very interesting is that the very first recording that he made of an opera singer that we know of was something that he did not do from the stage, but he got the very intelligent and bright Marcella Sembrich, who, by the way, not only was a hell of a good singer, but could play the violin and the piano. In fact, she even did a concert one night at the Met in which she did all three, a real triple threat gal. At any rate, she consented to let Mapleson, try this thing out. We play the cadenza from Voci di Primavera, Voices of Spring, unaccompanied. And just at the end of the cylinder, you hear Mapleson mention the name, and then the date March 3rd, and it got lost. However, now that we know that he bought that machine on St. Patrick's Day of 1900, we know that it can't be March 13th. So therefore, it's got to be the 30th or the 31st. This is just a little idea of some of the detective work involved in this kind of work. Let me do a little bit of a gloss on a briefing that I gave Harold Schoenberg in connection with the New York Times piece that he did on the Mapleson some weeks ago. Of course, I gave him 10 times as much as he needed, but that's what you do. Also, it was a very good way for me to do a quick update and summation for myself of where we stood with these things. Actually, when I went out to Long Island, I went out twice, as a matter of fact. There was a good deal more than just those diaries. I mentioned that I saw the family album. Most of the pictures that are known of Mapleson, one of the famous ones is this one of him holding the cylinder with his hands to his lips. You know, real showbiz type thing. Sorry. As I say, I wish I had the slides. The other frequently published photograph is this one of him leaning over the horn holding up a drive belt. There is yet another one which is too small to show here. It is a left-hand, it's a right-hand profile of him bending over the machine. And I discovered another interesting thing. One of our, I don't know whether he's an ARS member, Greytack, does that ring a bell, Les? Anyway, he's a well-known collector out on the West Coast, and he had heard about our work with the Maplesons and was writing me, and he said, I know that there are pictures of Mapleson that were published prior to the ones you mentioned. I mentioned, of course, the one that was published in Hobbies magazine in 1938, and of course the ones that appeared in Time magazine, High Fidelity, etc., and so forth. And he said, I swear I saw something in Musical America, but he gave me the wrong date. Luckily, the page from Musical America was right there in the Mapleson family album. So I had the date, and I went to our stacks, and there it was. It was published as part of a long interview with Lionel on December 6, 1924. It shows Mapleson with his machine and his cylinders, but not one single mention in the caption or anywhere in the body of the article. The body of the article doesn't mention Mapleson doing recordings at all. The caption mentions something very vaguely about Mapleson doing recording experiments, but no mention whatever of an extant collection. The first mention of that, as I said in the earlier article, was in New Yorker Talk of the Town. And then, of course, the Heilbutt and Gerber book, Backstage at the Opera. So, besides that, here were three other photographs, absolutely unpublished. One of them was simply a variant of the one with the drive belt. The other two, was a left-hand profile. And the most interesting one of all is you got a lady in the picture. That's his wife, Helen, who was a singer in the company. She started out in the chorus and eventually got up to singing solo parts even opposite Caruso. It turns out that she took those pictures. They were all taken on the same day at the same time. The background is unvarying. And again, Alfred told me something about how it happened. Lionel, it turns out, was a great gadgeteer and camera buff. He had his own dark room and was doing all his own processing from 4x5 glass plates way back when. And indeed, it is fascinating to go through those diaries and see the photographs that are pasted in. Some of you may remember that the Metropolitan Opera Company got stuck in the San Francisco earthquake. Caruso never would go back there after that. And there are all kinds of lurid stories. The opera Caravan by Quaintance Eaton has a very vivid description in which she also mentions Mapleson's activities with his camera. The entry in the diary for the day of the San Francisco earthquake has no words, just two photographs of San Francisco looking like Dresden the morning after. You get from the diaries, well, a matter of fact, one of the things we did is, you know, some of the cylinders have got the slips in them in Mapleson's writing. I took all those slips and Xeroxed them together on a page. Did several Xeroxes. I took a couple of them home to my wife, who was rather an expert in handwriting analysis, and she said, "What an original guy this is." And, well, when you look at the diary, it is an original. There are fascinating little stick drawings in the diary. He has a little drawing of a key with stick figures, in which he talks about the chorus singing off the key. And there are all kinds of clever little things in there. Ticket stubs from the Exposition Universelle in Paris, which he visited. You get a marvelous picture of this man. But this was the point that I tried to make before I, as they say, working my way up to going out to see the family. It took a while to convince Alfred and Peter that we were not collector nuts or, as they say, institutionalized maniacs. Basically, I said, "Look, we are interested in this thing as cultural historians, not even as archivist specialists. We are interested in the totality of this thing and how it happened, why it happened, and the whole ambiance." And then, of course, going from there, from my point of view, what happened to the cylinders after Lionel died, why it happened. Why did the New York Public Library acquire its cylinders in three batches? What happened essentially, again, you know, quickly, if you remember the original article, the major batch of cylinders Seltzum got, first he borrowed two cylinders from Lionel because of Geraldine Farrar offering an introduction. And by the way, I have got the original Farrar letters now, in which she said, "Here is my card, and I'm sure that this will do the trick." But we now, thanks to Glendon Good, who was one of Seltzum's heirs, we have the original letters. And, you know, as they say, one thing leads to another. So that nailed down the business of how Seltzum, as they say, got the cylinders. First two while Mapleson was alive, and then when Lionel died, he persuaded Alfred to let him have whatever other cylinders were left. Initially, they were on loan. The whole thing added up to about, 120 cylinders. Then, about a year or so after Seltzum got the batch of cylinders, came the next batch from this H.B. Bretnall, who turns out, thanks again to a communication from Aida Favia Arce, to have been a rather assiduous collector, who evidently found not only the New York Public Library batch of 12, but quite a few others in a junk shop in Brooklyn. But talking to Phil, and again putting things together from the library file, evidently when these things were played for the library, the music division staff with Lauder Greenway present, they did not take everything that Mr. Bretnall had to offer, but made a selection of 12. And meanwhile, Aida, in the late 1950s, picked up, I guess, more or less the remainder of what Bretnall had. For a long time, you know, it never was sure where she got these from, but I kept pounding and pounding and pounding, and finally I got a letter from her saying, "Yes, I did get these from Mr. Bretnall, and Mr. Bretnall is not the mysterious person that you think he is. We spent hours sitting around the kitchen table talking about this and that and the other thing." So that settles at least partially the provenance of Mr. Bretnall and also the provenance of the 10 Aida Favia Arce cylinders. Well, when I was out there in December, they happened to show me an old hat box that belonged to Lionel. I put my nose in there. 16 cylinders. Look at some of the containers. Well, now this is interesting because here is some stuff. You remember my referring in the original article to the Glackens Bishop notebook, which is the Rosetta Stone, essentially, for identifying most of the cylinders. When Seltzman got these cylinders, Ira Glackens, who authored the definitive biography of Lillian Nordica, Yankee Diva, was living in his mother's house on Gramercy Park. Ira told me this. He has visited us since, and we've had a long correspondence. And he told me, as they say, eyeball to eyeball, on how they went through these cylinders. But the fact remains that when they did this thing, they had the cylinders and the containers were more or less together, and the data that they put down in that notebook, they did not put down out of thin air. Hence, the discovery that the so-called Melba cylinder is not Melba, but Susan Adams. The evidence is pretty conclusive on that point, and the reasons why are mentioned in the article. But at any rate, at the end of the article, I mention a bunch of cylinders that apparently were broken or lost. Well, some of these broken or lost cylinders turned out to be in that hot box. Seltzman, evidently, in keeping with his promise in the early days that these were on loan, returned a few of these things to Alfred Mapleson. Of course, some of the containers had fascinating notations on them. Ternina Jean de Reschke, Götterdämmerung. Sic transit gloria mundi. At any rate, when I went out the second time, I persuaded Alfred. I looked at some of these the unpublished photographs. I knew that the plates no longer existed. I had pretty well verified that the only one plate existed, and even that one was cracked. So I said, would you mind? I said, I think I can have these restored for you. If you don't have them restored, you're not going to have anything. My daughter, thank goodness, is a very skilled darkroom technician, because I was not going to trust them anyplace else but in my own hot little hand. And if anybody was going to restore them, I was going to stand over them, so to speak. And they were very successfully restored, I might add. And there are prints in the library. And at any rate, as they say, that particular piece of fat has been pulled out of the fire. Well, now what about these 16 cylinders? I persuaded them the second time around. And by this time, I had sent them cassettes of what we had done, including the children. And that really had them interested. So they said, okay, you know, you can borrow them. And we took them back to the archive, and some of them were totally unusable. They had been too badly heat damaged or broken or whatever. Two or three of them turned out to be exactly items that were mentioned in the Glackens Bishop notebook. The one real discovery was a new bit from the O Noble Lam in Lisseed, which I am at this point fairly convinced is Jean de Reschke. We had John Stratton, who is the great scholarly authority on Mapleson, and Phil Miller imprisoned in the studio for the better part of a day, listening to these and some of our other more or less new discovery. There are still identification problems. Tom will tell you all about the pitching problems and all that, and we have only literally in the last week finished the pitching work and got all this stuff in order, opera by opera, onto cassette, and I have to sit down with this stuff and study it and think about it and live with it, so that when the time comes that, assuming that there are no legal complications, that we can get something out for public issue, that's beyond our research tape for on-premises listening, if we can get something out for public issue, it's going to be right, and we will have gotten all the information that is possible to get. And I think I better turn the show over to Tom now. We even made a little movie, by the way, which you're going to see. So, Tom, you take it.
As you can tell, David's done his homework on this, and it's been a very time-consuming and good experience, rewarding experience. We made the film. I have to take the credit and all of the blame for this film.
How many hours and minutes are totally now preserved on tape from the cylinders?
About 4 hours.
And how many cylinders altogether, counting the 16 now?
100 and let me get the statistics here. I have them, you know, I have them, as they say, accurately. Well, yeah, there are 154 bits. The Lionel Mapleson's wax cylinder plus family vignettes comprise 160 cylinders that have been accounted for to date. 135 are still extant. The missing one, however, exists as a lacquer transfer. The Library of Congress broke one. But thank God it was intact on the lacquer. I mentioned that in the first article. But we've dug everything out that could be dug.
So now all of these were recorded on the home with the Bettini recorder?
So far as we know, we have, you know, in other words, since apparently the original home machine probably got left in England somewhere. You know, in other words, Alfred indicates that he sent this to his mother. So we have never been able to recover the original machine, but presumably he used Bettini parts. He experimented with diaphragms, and then getting to the horn briefly, I didn't finish up on
that's
the horn
thing. My question was going to be, fine.
Since he was a gadgeteer, and he loved gadgets, and he did his own darkroom work, and this is pure speculation. Since there is no direct evidence linking him to Edison, if there is any direct evidence that either disappeared in the fire in 1914, I believe it was, or is buried somewhere among the Mapleson memorabilia on Long Island, which, you know, it'll be the Greek Kalends before people get to it, I fear. So we have no direct proof, but there is no reason to believe on the basis of circumstantial evidence. He was mad about typewriters also. He taught himself to type back in 1900 or thereabouts. Presumably he saw a talking machine world where they had all kinds of horn specs, and there's no reason why he couldn't have taken, you know, some of these drawings down to the Met Carpenter shop and said, build this. We will never know for sure, at least not yet. But that's, you know, we've carried the search about as far as we can go. Yes, George.
Well, I was curious about one thing. On that videotape, you demonstrated a record that obviously was not in prime shape. It was moldy and rather noisy. But compared to some moldy old brown wax cylinders I have heard and seen, that wasn't really so bad. Was that typical or one of the less god-awful ones?
It was sort of medium.
There are others worse.
We have some real basket cases, and we have some spectacularly good ones. Spectacularly good.
Yes. Hello there, I'm Len Kunstadt, and we recently did a study on a black singer by the name of Black Patty. And I have a couple of questions. In the Mapleson cylinders that are still in a puzzle category, have you seen anything that has a name like either Ciceretta Jones or Matilda Joyner?
No.
Or do you know of an opera by Mascagni? Skippus, let's see, which he mentioned that she was approached by Mascagni for a new opera called Scipio Africanus, which may have some kind of relation to the possibly. Did you see anything like that on any Mapleson cylinder?
Not a thing. Not
has anybody ever? Does anybody know about a Scipio Africanus?
Phil Miller, where
by
are
Mascagni.
Dave Hamilton. Never heard of it. It may have been a project.
The source is Ciceretta Jones giving this information in a black paper, I believe in the Amsterdam News or New York Age, all the way back about 1908. I have reference to it in a record research magazine, in which she quoted that she was approached by Mascagni to sing the title role. Now, it never went any further whether the opera ever came out or whether she did it or not.
Well, regrettably, this hasn't anything to do with Mapleson. Mapleson was working strictly with Met personnel.
Did Mapleson record in Carnegie Hall, or just...
Not that we know of. The only things that survive are the things that we have. We have all of the known extant cylinders. If any of you guys can turn up something, if he must have done recording in England, but they don't survive.
Of course, she was a resident over there, too.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
We can't help you.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
One thing that I'd like to say, prior work was done on the cylinders from Bob Cornell did the original work, and then Wilfried Zahn in Germany did some work before we got to them. No, I think I'll save this for the technical session, all right? The other thing is, there's this paper that I wrote, John Fessler and I wrote, where we went out and we made recordings with all sorts of different horns and things and three different machines under anechoic conditions. Mike Gray, wherever he may be, has said he's going to publish this paper. The AES is going to give permission to have his paper published in the Ars Journal, as well as some questions, common questions that were taken from conversations from myself and Barton Wimble and Bill Storm and Michael Lane and some other things. Simple one question, one answer things like what size stylus to use and all that sort of thing. That's supposed to be coming up in the next issue, so I promise.
One quick word about publication. There will be a Mapleson afterword covering the ground that we've covered here that will appear in the journal. There is also an in-depth scholarly treatment that is appearing in Recorded Sound, which is to say that part one of the article covers much the same ground as the journal article, but in considerably more depth and detail, and the second part will have a cylinder-by-cylinder tabulation, including extrapolation of Mapleson's original speed, the groove area, as they say, everything you always wanted to know, but maybe were afraid to ask. Steve, you have a question.
Yes, my question concerned the cleaning of the cylinder that you showed us in terrible condition there.
Okay, is Ed Catalano here? Okay. Ed Catalano is the chief chemist at LAST, which Liquid Archive of Sound Treatment. I sent him, went into the back room and collected all the fragments of the broken cylinders that I could find of the brown, black, concert cylinder, every vintage that I could find. Sent it to him, and he very graciously ran them through his analyzer and his centrifuge and everything else, and he came back with quite an astonishing report. We found that this mold spots can be washed off two different ways. If you want to get risky, you can do it ultrasonically, or if you want to do what we did in a couple of cases, we took an old home and we fixed up a sort of Keith Monk's record cleaner for cylinders. We put the cylinder on the home, we used the brush, got the plunger to put water, just distilled water through it, and held the brush against the grooves, and then vacuumed it off or hit it with an air gun.
There we were, standing over the sink.
Yeah. So that's how we washed the cylinders. The ones that were in pieces, the way they were played back, and there were several that were actually a heavy plastic was put around the mandrel and then painted with fingernail polish. And the cylinder was molded onto the mandrel left overnight, and then we would transfer it the next day and then pull it off the mandrel. And then, of course, it would all fall apart again. But that's how I forget which ones they were.
That was the Mara'i Aida excerpt, the priestess bit from the temple scene. But that thing was absolutely literally in pieces. And these were things that Glacken said in his gramophone article and in his list and his inventory, that this is absolutely hopeless. You can't possibly do anything with it. We even took the broken cylinder of the Faust Trio with Encore and recorded what we could of it. Fortunately, again, it was complete on a Library of Congress acetate. By the way, it was the Library of Congress that did... besides the early Seltzums from 1939-40, the Library of Congress was the next to do cylinder-to-disc transfer, and the engineer for that, as I mentioned, was Jerome Wiesner.
We also might put in a plug for Richard. Without the pack burn, the cylinders would have sounded much, much worse. Any other questions?
Do you have something to play this version?
It's up to David.
We don't advise it, really. I think it's much better that you come up to room 1804. All right, let's put this one on. This is something.
Well, we have one more question, Lynn.
Yeah, while he's doing that, in reference to our oral history, I have not been at all the recent meetings, and I'm wondering, is this the first time we've used videotape?
I believe so. No. Is it?
No. Or have we done it before?
I think it was done in Washington.
The question I have is, when will you have the Mapleton cylinders on video disc?
As soon as we talk somebody into giving us about $100,000
for, you're going to get the wax clean out of your ears. These are excerpts from Die Walküre, as they say, live from the Met.
Thank you.
These were all stage recordings.
Why is that one so much closer?
Because he was experimenting all the time. You can hear from time to time metallic sounds, which means that he's pushing that horn around, trying to get a focus on it.
Was that Gadsky in the first?
Yeah, Gadsky was Gadsky and then Nordica.
Now, might that last one have been from the prompter's box, or his other?
He was only in the prompter's box in 1901, and he started using the big horn in the season of 1902-03. I mean, 01-02. In other words, he never recorded until after the first of the year. So the prompter's box records were done in the spring of 01, and then the following season, and from there on he used the horn.
Maybe
Alfred Hertz, yes. Good man.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I think it's time to tour. Thank you.
Okay, thank
Bill.
You very much.
Thank you. Dick.